seems to get lost in our community. You'll find lots of people who don't want to say open source, and they'll say open source instead. And the reason is that that way they don't rock any head of the votes. They don't have to allude to the idea of freedom at all. They can present it purely as a matter of how to get a better technical job done. But free software is about something much more important than that. It's not about technical details at all. It's about freedom and social solidarity. Those are the goals of the free software movement. A program is free software if it gives you the four essential freedoms, which are freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish, freedom one, the freedom to study the source code and change it so that the program does what you wish, freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor, which is the freedom to distribute copies to others when you wish, and freedom three, the freedom to contribute to your community, the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. Now, none of these is a requirement, just a freedom. You should be free to do these things when you wish, but you're never required to do them. You don't ever have to study the source code and change it. You can just run it the way you got it, if that's good enough. You don't have to redistribute copies, but you can. If you make a modified version, you don't have to distribute copies, but you can. You don't even have to run the program, but you can. And note how these freedoms also relate to social solidarity. Freedoms zero and one are freedoms to do things purely for yourself, but freedoms two and three are the freedom to do things for others. Now, there is a common tendency to imagine that freedom and helping others are opposed, but here we have freedom and altruism on side by side against being divided and conquered by somebody else. And that's exactly what non-free software does. A non-free program keeps the users divided and helpless. Divided because they're forbidden to share it, and helpless because they don't have the source code, so they can't change it. User subjugating software is the problem that we are trying to get rid of. But why are these four freedoms essential? Freedom two, the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to distribute exact copies to others when you wish, is essential on basic moral grounds so that you can live an upright life as a good member of your community. If you use a program that doesn't give you freedom too, you're in danger of falling into a moral dilemma at any moment. Whenever your friend says, that program's nice, could I have a copy? At that moment, you will have to choose between two evils. One is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. The other is to deny your friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. You ought to choose the lesser evil, which is to give your friend a copy and violate the license. Now, what makes this the lesser evil? If you can't help doing wrong to somebody, better to do it to somebody who has done wrong and deserves it. We can assume that your friend is a good friend, a helpful person, and normally someone you'd want to cooperate with, because the other case is easy to deal with, so forget it. So in that case, we compare your friend against the developer of the proprietary program who has deliberately attacked the social solidarity of your community. So if you have to do wrong to one or the other, do it to the developer. But being the lesser evil is not the same as being good. It's never a good thing to make an agreement and break it. Now, there are agreements like this kind which are inherently evil, and keeping them is worse than breaking them, but breaking them is still bad. And if you do give your friend a copy, he will have an unauthorized copy of a proprietary program, which is something pretty bad, ethically speaking. is don't have any friends. Implicitly, the proprietary software developers propose this. The other is reject proprietary software. If you don't have this program, you can't fall into the dilemma. And that is the way I've chosen to avoid this. If someone offers me a program on the condition that I promise not to share it with you, then no matter how useful or attractive it is, I say no. I say, my conscience will not allow me to accept your conditions, so take your filthy program out of my office. So that's the reason for freedom number two. What about freedom zero, the freedom to run the program? Well, that's necessary so you can have control of your own computing. You must reject software that restricts your execution of the program. But that's not enough to give you control of your own computing, because the developer could control you through the code of the program by deciding that it will do this and it won't do that. So to really have control, you need freedom one, the freedom to study and change the source code to make the program do what you wish. If you don't have that freedom, you can't even tell what the program does. And many proprietary programs have malicious features. Lots of them spy on the user, for instance. One proprietary program you may have heard of that spies on the user is called Microsoft Windows. But spying is not limited to Windows. Windows Media Player also spies on the user. It says everything the user looks at. But please do not think that Microsoft is the only company that's evil. There are lots of proprietary software developers, and they're all evil, and lots of them make software spy on people. For instance, RealPlayer spies on the user, too, exactly the same way. And I would expect that RealPlayer did it first, because Microsoft is more known for imitation than for invention. But it gets worse than just spying. There's also the functionality of refusing to function, where the program says, I don't want to let you look at this file, even though it's in your computer. I don't want to let you copy part of this file, even though it's in your computer. I don't want to print this file for you, because I don't like you. And I'm not here to serve you anyway. That was a lie. I'm here to serve somebody else who wants to have power over you. That's what I was written for. This is also known as Digital Restrictions Management, or DRM, the intentional malicious feature of refusing to function for you. Now, this is very common. Microsoft does it, Apple does it, Adobe does it, Google does it, and it's wrong no matter who does it. We have a campaign against this, which you can find in the site defectivebydesign.org. Go there and sign up to participate in our protests. It's a lot of fun to participate in a protest. If you've never done it, give it a try. You'll love it. We have protested Microsoft, we've protested Apple, we've protested movie theaters. Right now we have a campaign aimed at Netflix to tell them that there's opposition to DRM, so they shouldn't try it. And I hope we'll have protests in public libraries, which are distributing audiobooks with DRM, letting themselves be turned effectively into retail stores. That's what restricting people from sharing does to libraries. It turns them into retail stores when they start distributing online. So, this is very nasty, but it's getting worse in most areas. In fact, Windows Vista was designed specifically to restrict the users more than ever before. In fact, the Green Party joined with the Free Software Foundation to condemn Windows Vista, and the reason is it's designed to make people throw away working hardware and replace it. And why do they do that? Because that hardware was not designed to restrict you enough to satisfy Microsoft's desires. So they said, we'll make people stop using that hardware and buy a replacement that was designed to restrict them completely. That shows how arrogant they are. So we have another campaign called BadVista.org. I think there may be a few stickers for that out there. We urge people, if they're not ready to defenestrate their computers just yet, at least don't make things worse. Don't go to Windows Vista. There are also backdoors, the malicious features designed to attack the user. Now, one proprietary program you may have heard of that has a backdoor is called Microsoft Windows. You see, when it asks for an upgrade, Microsoft usually knows the identity of the user, more or less, and thus can give that user an upgrade designed specifically for him, which means just taking control of his computer. There might be others. A few years ago in India, I was told they had arrested some of the developers of Windows XP and accused them of working for Al-Qaeda, introducing another backdoor that Microsoft wasn't supposed to know about either. Well, apparently that attempt failed. We don't know if there were other similar attempts that succeeded, but we know that Microsoft itself introduced a backdoor for the use of another terrorist organization, which is even more violent than Al-Qaeda, namely the United States government. This was discovered in 1999. So you can't trust software that doesn't come with source code. If you don't have freedom number one, you're a prisoner of your software. And even if you're lucky and the software doesn't have malicious features, it surely has bugs because the programmers were human and they made mistakes. And you're just as helpless against an accidental, unintentional bug as you would be against a deliberate malicious feature. However, freedom one is not enough for real control of your own computing. And the reason is, that's the freedom to personally study and change the source code. And there's just so much free software that nobody could possibly study and master it all and personally make all the changes she might want. That's more than one person can do. So we need freedom three as well. Freedom three is the freedom to contribute to your community by distributing your modified versions to others. This enables us to work together, each one building on what others have already done, so that together we make progress in the direction that we want. And the result of these four freedoms is democracy. A free program develops democratically under the control of its users. It's not done through an election. It's not classical electoral democracy, but rather everybody can participate in changing the program as much or as little as he wants. And the sum total of all this is society's collection of decisions. So if you get if you have a lot of people who want to make progress in that direction, probably you will see changes frequently going in that direction and you'll have fast progress. And if a few people want progress in this direction, they can still do it, but probably it won't go as fast unless they're really enthusiastic. And most of all, if nobody wants progress in this direction, because they don't think that would be progress, it won't happen because nobody's in position to force it on anybody else. With proprietary software, the developer has power. The developer can force changes on the users and force users to swallow things that the developer doesn't want to change. And the only recourse that the users have is to escape to the free world. And that's the aim of the free software movement. You should all escape to the free world. The free world is a new continent that we have built in cyberspace. It's impossible to live in freedom in the old world, where every program has its lord who bullies and dominates the users. The only way to have freedom is to escape from non-free software and come to the free world. Because it's a virtual continent, there's room for everybody, and you're all invited. And because there were never any indigenous peoples in cyberspace, there's no issue about chasing them off their land. Everybody's welcome. So how did we build this continent? I started this in January 1984. I started developing a free software operating system. You see, the computer won't do any good without an operating system. So the first set of software we needed in order to use computers and have freedom was an operating system. There were no free operating systems, so I decided to write one. I decided to make it Unix compatible so that it would be portable and so that people would have an easy time switching to it. And then I gave it, being a hacker, I gave it a funny name, the recursive acronym GNU, which stands for GNU's Not Unix. That was the hacker tradition for how to give credit to an existing program when you wrote something similar. Give it a name that's a recursive acronym which says it's not the other program. So...
Are there examples of other instances of that?
Of other recursive acronyms?
FireAnt was originally called Ant for Ant's Non-TV, so a similar idea.
Okay, well, the first recursive acronym, as far as I know, was for an editor similar to Tico, which was called Tint, for Tint is not Tico. And then after I wrote the first Emacs, there were about 30 imitations, and one was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs. And there was Sign, for Sign is not Emacs. And Ina, for Ina is not Emacs. And Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. And version 2 of Ina was called Spy, for Spy was Ina initially. So you can have a lot of fun with recursive acronyms. In any case, during the 90s, or during the 80s, our job was to write all these components. We needed hundreds of components for a Unix-like system. And when it was almost finished, somebody else wrote a program that filled the last gap. That program is Linux, a kernel that was developed in 1991, which was initially not free software, but in 92, it was relicensed under the GNU General Public License. Now, part of this job of developing the GNU, in order to live in freedom, we had to have a free operating system, and in order to make a free operating system and make sure it would stay free, we needed a license that would defend the freedom of the programs it was used for. That license is the GNU General Public License, which I wrote. Now, initially, for each GNU program, there was a very similar license, but it had the name of the program in it. So, for instance, GNU Emacs was released under the GNU Emacs General Public License. And GCC was released under the GCC General Public License. This was inconvenient because that meant that Emacs and GCC had different licenses. They were almost identical, but they were different, which meant you couldn't copy code legally from one to the other. To solve that problem, I found a way to make the license be independent of the name of the program it was used in, which meant that you could just put this license into any program and it would be licensed under that. You just had to put the right notices on all the source files. And this meant that anybody could now perfectly easily use this license, even if he wasn't involved with the GNU project. And that's what Mr. Torvalds did. So once Linux became free software, we had a complete free operating system, which was basically GNU with Linux added. And thus, releasing Linux as free software was the step that carried us across the finish line. It was able to do that because of all the steps we'd taken previously. But at the same time, a confusion got started. People thought the whole system was Linux. And that had all been started by Mr. Torvalds. And they assumed it all came from his vision of what's important in life. Now, if he shared our appreciation of freedom and social solidarity, that would be okay. But in fact, he doesn't. He disagrees with what I told you today. And he would normally describe his work as open source, which is a way of not advocating freedom and not standing up for social solidarity. And the result is, when people think the GNU system is Linux and they attribute our work to him, they tend to follow his values instead of ours. And that's not good for the cause of freedom. Now, as you can see, if you look around this country, freedom is frequently threatened, and people who don't defend it are likely to lose it. In this country, we already have lost it, more or less. And it's a lot harder to win it back than it is to prevent it from being lost. So if people focus on the engineer values of open source, and they don't think about freedom as something important, what's that going to lead to? It means that they will be willing to sell their own freedom because they won't appreciate what they're losing. If we could magically produce free software today to do every job any user wants, then we could distribute it, and tomorrow every user could have freedom. But would they still have freedom in 5 years? Not necessarily, because some clever and unscrupulous person could develop during that time an attractive non-free program and then invite people to use it, and he would tell them they have to pay money. He wouldn't mention the fact that they're also paying their freedom, but it would be the case. But those people not valuing freedom might not object. So 5 years from now, we might not have freedom anymore. In 1992, the GNU/Linux system was free software. It was possible to run a PC with entirely free software. By 2000, you couldn't find a free distribution of GNU/Linux. There was none. The closest was Debian. Debian distributed and still distributes non-free software, but they defined it not to be part of their distribution. So in a pedantic sense, Debian didn't contain non-free software, but its servers did. Well, nowadays, I'm happy to say, finally, there are some entirely free distributions of GNU/Linux. For instance, there is Ubuntu, which is named after a lizard from Argentina. And there is GNuSense. But those are not the well-known distributions. The well-known distributions all contain non-free software. So what message are they carrying to the public? If you distribute non-free software, you're saying it must be okay. Otherwise, you have to be ashamed of yourself. If you don't say you're ashamed of yourself, it implies you think what you're doing is okay. So the distributors of those versions of GNU/Linux that contain or offer to install non-free software are endorsing it as legitimate. Thus, they're endorsing the message that people hear from all the proprietary software companies and all around us, and from the supporters of open source. So, where could they ever get the idea that there's an issue of freedom here? They have to get it from you. You need to tell people about freedom, just as I do it. I'm not enough. I'm one man. This is a job that's much bigger than one man can do. The most I can do is hope to get you started on doing it. You've got to teach other people about freedom, and you've got to do it whenever you've got to get a chance. So you can explain these issues to other people. But that takes some time. Maybe you don't have time to do that a certain day, but there's something else you can do that will help a lot, even though not quite as much, and it's much faster. It only takes a second, and that is calling the system GNU/Linux, because it takes just 1 second to say GNU/ or type GNU/. Now, you can't explain a philosophy in 1 second, but what you can do is make the users aware that they are users of the GNU system. And that way, later on, when they come across articles from the GNU developers about the philosophy of free software, instead of saying, well, that has nothing to do with me, I'm a Linux user, they will say, I'm using the GNU/Linux system, and here's an article about the philosophy of GNU. Maybe I should pay attention to this. Now, that won't guarantee that we can convince them, but at least we will have a chance to try if they read what we wrote. So you will be helping pave the way for our efforts to be more effective. And if you're willing to put more time into it by explaining to people about free software, then you can help even more. We are in a fight. And now we're in a fight with many large companies that want to prohibit free software because, as far as they're concerned, the most important thing in the world is to restrict what we can do on our computers. I don't like paying money to Hollywood because the Hollywood movie companies are among the biggest enemies of our freedom. They are the ones who paid for laws like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. They are principal conspirators in new DRM conspiracies like AACS. So the first step is they want to restrict what we do with published works. They're not even satisfied with a copyright law that restricts us too much. They want to take it even further. They want to get total control over what we do with our own copies of published works. And so they encrypt them and they release non-free software that implements digital restrictions management. And then, when people try to write free software to access the same things, they use the DMCA to attack those people. So they're attacking our freedom at two levels. First, there's our freedom in using our copies of published works. And second, there's the freedoms of free software, because they try to censor the free software and prevent us from having it. So I don't want to feed them. And so I recommend, but I realize that to recommend a total boycott of Hollywood might seem to some people to be going too far. So I have a different recommendation. Never pay anything to see a movie unless you have a reason to believe it is good. By your standards, of course. I'm not trying to tell you what you should consider good or bad in art. That's not the point. I'm asking you to pay attention to your own standards, because lots of people don't. Now, I realize that, practically speaking, this will add up to nearly to a total boycott of Hollywood. But it's not, in formal terms, a complete boycott. There is provision for an occasional exception. So, I think at this point, I should probably mention a few websites and then probably close. What time is it? I don't see anything on my wrist.
4:35.
Yeah, it's just about the right time, I guess. I'd like to ask if there is a teenage software enthusiast here who would like to do a religious ceremony in the Church of Emacs. The ceremony is simple. Just stand here and recite, perhaps in singing, part of the source of your favorite program, or a program you like. You don't have to have one favorite, after all. So that's all it is. It's called a FUBAR mitzvah. And there has never been one before. But volunteer. But before that, I should explain about the Church of Emacs. I should also explain that yesterday I seem to have lost an important cable. It's a cable that at one end would plug into a car cigarette lighter. And it's sort of a translucent white color with metal inside. And if you find a cable like that, please give it back to me. I know I used it on the way here. Software off of it now. So hacking, everybody. So I've got some FSF gear for sale, as well as stickers to give away. The gear includes little lapel pins for $10, key rings for $15, and USB keys with some privacy software on them for $30.
What's offered?
I don't actually know. It's a way to support the Free Software Foundation.
If you go to the FSF website, that's under there, it's like for MoFish and a few other suite of those.
And you can also join the FSF. You can do it, of course, through the website, but you can also do it right here because I have cards you can fill out. And if you do this, it's a way of supporting the FSF's work. I get none of this money. I'm a volunteer. But the FSF has other people who work on the staff, and your support enables us to pay them. So, thank you.
Can you use the microphone?